Cambridge, and you've all been very kind to fund me here for the year. So really what I wanted to do was use this opportunity to sort of introduce myself to the group, tell you a bit about what I do. And I actually spoke here in May about some of this stuff down here, the astrophysical tests. And what I didn't want to do was stand up and give the exact same talk again. So I'd like it to be slightly more informal. Rather than going into a lot of technical details, I'm going to talk a bit about some of the different projects I've worked on over the last couple of years. And the other thing I should warn you is that this talk is designed to overrun. I've included a lot of material here. And the reason for that is we're actually going to have an overflow session at the Gravity Group meeting tomorrow at 2:30 in the Gravity Room on the fourth floor. So if you're interested in any of the stuff, you want to discuss it more, there's going to be a discussion session 2:30 tomorrow in the Gravity Room.
Just one thing. So there is a talk at 1.
You mean today?
Yeah, so don't overrun.
Oh, yeah, no. Well, I'll stop at the time and then... It's designed to overrun, stop, and then carry on tomorrow. So what I really want to do is give you an introduction to what I do. If anyone's interested, if you want to get involved, if you've got any questions, feel free to come up and chat to me. So for that reason, I haven't really given it a formal title. I've called it What I Do. And the answer to that question is modified gravity. So let me just tell you exactly what I'm going to talk about in the next 50 minutes or so. I'm going to start off giving you a very quick motivation to why people study modified gravity and why I study modified gravity. I'm then going to introduce you to the type of modified gravity that I work on, hopefully having convinced you that it's worth pursuing, and that's modified gravity with screening mechanisms. I'm then very quickly and without any technical details going to talk a tiny bit about my work on supersymmetric completions, but mainly I'm going to talk to you about the work I've done on astrophysical tests, and there is new stuff compared to the talk I gave in May, so hopefully you won't get too bored. Then finally I'm going to tell you a bit about what I'm doing, some of the projects which I'm involved in or things that I'm thinking about, and I'll summarise at the end. Okay, so why do people study modified gravity? There are a couple of reasons for this, and one of the big cosmological motivations is dark energy. So we know that the universe is accelerating, and this is a bit strange because usually in Einstein gravity, everything in the universe pulls itself together. It would rather contract than accelerate. So this generally comes under the heading of dark energy. And if you want to account for dark energy in normal Einstein's theory of general relativity, you have to play around with this side of Einstein's equations. No, 69. Just dark energy, not dark matter. So generally, you fiddle around with this side of Einstein's equations. You add something funny to the energy momentum tensor, some weird exotic matter. This thing's got a negative pressure, and it makes the universe accelerate. So you can then ask the question, well, what if I don't play around with this side? What if I play around with this side and modify the geometry? But it turns out there's a theorem from Weinberg which says, actually, if you make any modification to general relativity, you necessarily introduce a new degree of freedom. So in some sense, the two approaches are equivalent. If you want to study dark energy, then in some sense, you're studying a modified theory of gravity. If you're not cosmologically inclined, if you're more of a particle physics person, sometimes you don't have a choice, you're stuck with a modified theory of gravity. So there are lots of different beyond the standard model theories. These are theories of gravity. And they generically predict scalar degrees of freedom which couple to matter. So just for an example, the low energy effective action of string theory in four dimensions has a string dilaton coupled to the Ricci scalar. Unless you stabilize this with a very, very large mass, you've got a long-range modification of general relativity. And then finally, there's an aesthetic reason, and that's completeness. So it's true that we've performed lots of different experiments testing general relativity, but these have only really been performed in our own solar system, our own galaxy. Gravity is actually not very well constrained on cosmological scales. Upcoming missions like Euclid will probe the structure on cosmological scales. And there are select objects like neutron stars where we've performed these tests, but there's still a very, very large range of scales where gravity hasn't really been tested. And so you could ask the question, can I get novel features on very large scales without screwing up these solar system tests? And these are the sort of theories which I study. So, where are we? There we go. Of course, that's the problem with these modified theories of gravity. We have tested gravity very, very well in our own solar system. Any modification that we make has to be compatible with these experiments. And these experiments are very tight. So if you've got some sort of universal force, I'm going to call extra forces in modified gravity fifth forces. The ratio of the fifth force to the Newtonian force has to be less than 10 to the minus 5. If you violate the weak equivalence principle, it has to be less than 10 to the minus 13.
Is it true that we have tested gravity on very large scales, with the CMB?
That's why
you have to be very close to a cosmological constant.
So the way you can do this is you can parameterize the difference from things like between, say, the two potentials, phi and psi, so they're equal in general relativity, and you can parameterize these differences using modified parameterizations.
You already know in advance they have to, those differences have to be quite small, it's because we have tested gravity on large scales.
Not necessarily. What happens if you test with another theory of gravity, you'll get very, very tight constraints from the fact that you have to have very small deviations from lambda CDM. If you let gravity vary in general, so if you just write down a generalized slip equation and a generalized Poisson equation, what you find is that, I haven't got the slide here, but I can show you it later, the constraints are actually quite weak. You can have reasonably large deviations and just change your parameters slightly.
Under some measure.
Sorry?
Standardized deviations under some measure.
Yeah. Right.
Do not have any constraint of 10 to the minus 5 from plus 1, so I guess, maybe it's fair to say it's weaker, I bet there are some constraints, but not at the strongest.
It's a paper by Bean and Tatting. There's quite a large range in the parameter space. It's quite a big contour once you allow gravity to vary in general. It's one of these very subtle points, because you will get very strong constraints if you just test a version of gravity versus lambda CDM. If you just let gravity vary in general, this is how you open up the region in the contour space.
The same is true with quintessence.
Yeah. It's very degenerate with quintessence as well. You have to look for
novel strings. The constraints on W0 would be a giant. But if you test a specific theory, a specific potential, they're very
good. You get very, yeah.
It's just kind of saying that you're fried
through. So yeah, you might turn around to me and you might say, well, general relativity is so well tested, why are you bothering to do this? And it turns out there's a get-out clause to these solar system tests. And the clause is, well, we've only tested these things in our own solar system. If I can find some mechanism by which I get general relativity on very small scales but novel deviations on large scales, then I satisfy my solar system tests and I've got a viable theory of gravity. So let me tell you a bit about how we generally do this. Okay, so I'm going to consider a single scalar field which is coupled to matter, and I'm going to consider perturbations of this scalar field around some background value to second order in field perturbations. So there's only really a few terms I can write down here. I can have some non-canonical kinetic term for the field, I can have an effective mass of the field, and I can have some coupling to matter. So this coupling of the field to the trace of the engine momentum tensor, this is what gives me my modification of gravity, and I can parameterize that by some coupling strength beta. And it's this thing which gives rise to the fifth forces. So how exactly can I screen out these modifications? Well, if this non-canonical kinetic term is large, once I canonically normalize this field, I'm going to suppress beta by a factor of root z, and so I can make my coupling to matter negligible. If I make my effective mass very large, then the range of my force is going to be very small. It's going to be a very short-range force. If I can make this sub-millimeter or so, I can pass all of my solar system tests. And finally, if I can just somehow make this coupling to matter small, I'm going to get no fifth forces whatsoever. I'm not going to be able to detect them. So there's a few mechanisms in the literature now which make use of this. There's the Weinstein mechanism, which uses the kinetic terms. Then there's a chameleon mechanism, which makes use of the mass term, and the symmetron mechanism, which makes use of the coupling. I'm mainly going to talk about these theories here, but I have started to work on observational tests of these theories as well. Okay, so let me introduce you to chameleon-type theories. If it goes... Yep, okay, so the action looks something like this. I've got the usual Einstein-Hilbert gravity term. I've got a canonically normalized scalar field, except the factor of the half's missing. And I've got some scalar potential V of phi. So at the moment, this looks like a boring old quintessence model. There's nothing new here. The difference is actually in the matter Lagrangian. So instead of coupling... making contractions with the metric g mu nu, I'm going to use a conformally rescaled metric a squared times g mu nu, and this is what gives me my modifications of gravity. And what this means is the effective metric matter particles c is not actually this one here that I've put into the Ricci scalar, it's this conformally rescaled one here, the Jordan frame metric. This means if I observe in the Einstein frame, I've put this metric into R. I say things should move on geodesics of this metric, not this one, and so I infer the presence of a fifth force. The fifth force is given by this expression here, so it depends on the gradient of the scalar and this coupling function beta, and I've defined beta of phi like this. It's just a logarithmic derivative. So how exactly can I screen out my force? You gonna go? Yeah. Well, there's two novel features which arise here, and the most important one is this. So it turns out that the scalar which I put into my action, the scalar potential V of phi, is not the effective potential which my scalar feels. it feels V of phi plus the density times this coupling function A of phi. So suppose then that I arrange this potential such that I've got a minimum. The location of this minimum depends on how dense my environment is. If it depends on how dense my environment is, it means I can move the field value around as a function of where I am in the universe. And so if I can somehow move it to some advantageous position in field space on small scales, I can hopefully screen out my force. And mechanisms have been found which have done this. So if I move it to a position where the curvature is very high and I've got a large effective mass, then the force is submillimeter, I can screen out forces that way. That's how the chameleon mechanism operates. If I can somehow move it to positions where this coupling beta is very, very small, this fifth force is going to be negligible, and I'm going to screen out my force like that. Right. I'm going to go. Okay, right. So I'm going to introduce you to two of these mechanisms, because both of them are going to be important later on. The first one's the chameleon mechanism, where you take a runaway scalar potential, so this blue line here. You take a monotonically increasing coupling function, so this thing here, and you get a new potential, an effective potential with a minimum. So at low densities, you can see the second derivative is quite small. It's not very curved, and you've got a low mass. So at low densities, you can have a long-range force and an interesting modification of gravity. In high-density environments, you get a much steeper potential, you get a higher mass, and you can screen out your force using that. And people like these theories because F of R theories are chameleon theories for certain choices of F. The other mechanism is actually one due to Kurtz, sorry, I didn't put the reference on, which is called the symmetron. In this case, you take a Z2 symmetry breaking potential, which looks like this, and a quadratic coupling function. And so you get an effective potential where the mass term for the scalar can be either positive or negative, depending on the density. If I'm in a very low density environment, I get a symmetry broken phase, which looks like this. My field sits over here, and I get beta of phi of order 1. If I'm in very high densities, the symmetry is restored. My field value shifts to 0. Beta is 0. And I screened out my fifth force. Okay, so slightly later on, I'm going to tell you exactly when an object is going to be screened and when it's not. But in the meantime, I just want to have this basic picture in mind. I can only screen my object if I can swing my field to the minimum of the effective potential, because this is where the screening occurs. So I can have two situations. I can either have the screen situation, where very far away the field sits at some different minimum, and it very quickly minimizes its effective potential in high densities. Or I can have the unscreened situation, where I've got some very large region in between where I've got a gradient, and this is where I'm going to feel my fifth forces. But for the moment, the picture I'd like to have you in mind is this, if it comes up. Okay. So very, very far away from some spherical object, the field asymptotes to its cosmological value or its value in that medium. There's some screening radius, RS, at which point it minimizes its effective potential. And somewhere in between, there's an unscreened region where there are some large field gradients, and this is where I'm going to get all of my fifth forces. So let me just introduce you to exactly how we parameterize this. So for astrophysical tests, there's a model-independent parameterization. There are two parameters. The first one is alpha, and alpha tells me how strong my fifth force is when I'm unscreened. So very roughly, I can change g by a factor of 1 plus alpha. And just to give you some idea of the scale, this is not a very small number. This is an order 1 number. These are gravitational strength forces. So for example, F of R gravity has alpha equals a third. The other parameter I'm going to introduce you to is called chi0. Chi0 is what I like to call a self-screening parameter, and it tells you how good an object is at screening itself. So the rule of thumb is, if I want to know whether an object screens or not, I take chi0, I compare it to the Newtonian potential. If chi0 is greater than the Newtonian potential, my object's going to be at least partially unscreened. If the converse is true, my object's going to be very screened. And why do I call it the self-screening parameter and not the screening parameter? Well, actually, you can be screened by environmental Newtonian potentials as well as your own Newtonian potential. So suppose I've got an object that would be unscreened, and I put it over here. But I then take a much larger object and put it next to it. This larger object is going to have a large Newtonian potential. It's going to filter out over here, and it's going to screen this object out. And this is actually an advantage, because this is how we actually do astrophysical tests. And I'll come back to that slightly later on. Let me just give you an example of some of the sort of ranges for chi0 which we're talking about. At 10 to the minus 4 and 10 to the minus 5, you're comparable with the Bardeen potential on cosmological scales. And this means you get novel effects on things like galaxy clustering, the halo mass function, the peculiar velocity power spectrum. And you can go out and do cluster statistics, and you can place a constraint. Chi0 is roughly less than 10 to the minus 5. If you want to go to slightly smaller values, then you need to look at objects like main sequence stars and spiral galaxies, because these have Newtonian potentials of order 10 to the minus 6. So, for example, the Sun has this Newtonian potential. Chi0 is the self-screening parameter, so I compare this to the Newtonian potential, and if it's larger than that, I'm going to be unscreened. So this is, you can think of it as the mass of the field or the effective range of the field compared with Hubble. Okay, oop, that's where I wanted to be. We can go back, can't you?
It's not the mass of the field because it's dimensionless.
It looks like H0 squared over the mass squared, so it's the mass compared with the Hubble. If you want to probe into slightly smaller values of Chi0, you need to look at objects which are even more underdense than this. So you need to look at post-main sequence stars. These are stars which have the same mass as, say, the Sun, but their radius is 10 to 100 times larger, so they can probe Chi0 in the range 10 to minus 7. And finally, the most unscreened objects in the universe are dwarf galaxies. Dwarf galaxies have rotational speeds of order 50 kilometers per second. So if you just use the virial theorem, this comes out as Newtonian potentials of order 10 to minus 8. People have looked at dwarf galaxies at placing constraints. Currently, the data's not competitive, so you can't actually use them to place constraints on Chi0, but what you can use them for is laboratories for other objects like post-main sequence stars, and this is what I'm going to use them for.
But what about the environmental potential?
Yes. Okay, I'm going to come on to that in just a second. So dwarf galaxies sitting by themselves in cosmological voids are going to be unscreened. They've got Newtonian potentials of order 10 to the minus 8, so I can use them as laboratories. If I've got a dwarf galaxy in a cluster, this is going to be unscreened by the environmental effects, as you said. And so by looking for systematic offsets between two different samples, I can build up constraints like that. We've got a few. I think the final sample was around 27 for the test that we use. And until recently, this was a bit of a pipe dream, but recently this group here, they've used data from the SDSS to put out a screening map, so we can got a good idea of which galaxies are going to be screened as a function of Chi0. And so they classify like this: if the self-Newtonian potential is greater than Chi0, it's self-screened. If the external potential is greater than Chi0, they call it environmentally screened. And they've calibrated this against n-body codes, and they get very good agreement. Right, so that's just an introduction to the sort of theories that I work on. What am I going to tell you about in this talk? I'm very quickly going to talk about some work on supersymmetric completions, just so you don't feel that I've given you the same talk that I gave in May. Then I'm going to go on to some astrophysical tests, and I've done some new work on that. And then if I've got time at the end, I'll tell you about some of the things that I'm working on and some of my upcoming projects. So let me tell you a bit about supersymmetric completions. Why these are modified theories of gravity? They're quite complicated already. Why would I want to make them even more complicated? Well, there's a few reasons. First of all, you might want to make contact with fundamental physics and have some more of a unified theory. You might find that once you supersymmetrize things, you can get new constraints or new observational signatures. But most importantly, the fact is chameleon theories are unstable to quantum corrections. So if you take the one loop effective potential, just a la Kalman-Weinberg, it's proportional to the mass to the fourth. But I've already told you that these things screen in very dense environments by increasing their mass by several orders of magnitude. So the same mechanism which screens you kills you off on the quantum level. And so actually there's only a very narrow window of parameters which are not ruled out by lab tests and which are stable to quantum corrections.
Are you going to be able to help there without making the Suzy scale unreal?
I'm going to tell you about that. Okay. So why supersymmetry in particular? Well, first of all, string theory is supersymmetric. You might want to make contact with that. It's a nice calculational framework. There's a lot of general results you can use which don't have to be done on a model-by-model basis. But most importantly, we don't have a choice in the matter. You could say, why don't I impose some other symmetry? Why don't I make it some Lie symmetry which is softly broken? But the problem with this is if I do that, my chameleon's going to be a Goldstone boson. Goldstone bosons have a technically natural mass. You cannot vary over very large magnitudes without completely breaking the symmetry and destroying all your symmetry-preserving properties. Supersymmetry is an exception in that you predict a Goldstone fermion instead. So this is really the motivation for looking at supersymmetric theories. So I'll tell you about how I do this. There are other attempts as well in the literature. I'm going to tell you about a very simple model which we have where we only couple to dark matter for precisely the reason we're saying at the moment I can't find a way of coupling to normal matter without without having a horrible breaking scale, but I do have a new mechanism which I'm starting to look at. So for those of you who don't know anything about supersymmetry, this is not going to be a problem because this is the only slide where I'm going to do a technical construction. The rest is all going to be results. So for those of you who are interested in this, the way we do it is we take two dark matter fields, phi plus and phi minus, and a gravity superfield phi. We have a Kähler potential which looks like this, and a superpotential which looks like a function of the gravity superfield only, and some coupling to the dark matter fields. If you calculate the mass of the dark matter fields, you get fermion masses which look like this, and this means that you get a density-dependent term in your effective potential for the scalar, and so you end up with an effective potential which looks like this. Right, so let me address your question about supersymmetry breaking. In this model, you get environment-dependent supersymmetry breaking. You don't get supersymmetry breaking from, say, TV scale physics or from some hidden sector breaking. And if you just minimize this effective potential, you get an equation which looks like this. So for those of you who don't know about supersymmetry, if this thing dw by d phi is zero, I've got unbroken supersymmetry. If it's not equal to zero, I get broken supersymmetry. And because of this density-dependent term on the side, you've always got supersymmetry breaking. And it's actually density dependent. How broken your supersymmetry is depends on where you are in the universe, which was a nice new effect. Generally, it depends on the parameters you put into your model, but it's always a lot lower than, say, TV scale, so it's a lot less than the MSSM scale. But because of this supersymmetry breaking, you don't generally expect cancellations in general. You'll always expect some sort of correction to your mass. What other new features do we get? Well, you can look at supergravity corrections, and it turns out supergravity corrections place very, very strong constraints on what sort of chameleon theories I'm allowed to write down in supersymmetry. So if I just look at the supergravity breaking corrections, it turns out there's a contribution to the effective mass of my scalar, which is of order the Gravitino mass, and the Gravitino mass must be at least 1 electron volts to be compatible with current particle physics tests, and this has some interesting effects. So the first interesting effect, it completely rules out all supersymmetric symmetrons. So I can write down a supersymmetric symmetron theory, it looks like that. The supersymmetry is not important. What is important is you get a symmetron potential which looks like this, except now you've got two terms in the mass term. It looks like this thing here minus m3/2. And remember, with the symmetron, this thing's positive, this thing has to be positive as well. So if I want to have a symmetron which can break the Z2 symmetry, this thing here needs to be greater than m3/2, which means that the mass at zero density must be at least the Gravitino mass. So you can go through and say, well, what's the sort of density where I restore my symmetry and I screen out my fifth force? It turns out it's 10 to the 39 times the current critical density. The density here on Earth is 10 to the 29 times the current critical density. So this says essentially you can't screen in galaxies, you can't screen around the Earth. Supersymmetric symmetrons cannot screen out fifth forces. So already this construction rules out supersymmetric symmetrons. What about other screening mechanisms? Other screening mechanisms have a very strong no-go theorem associated, which I like to call super screening. So if I just minimize the effective potential for a different screening mechanism like a chameleon, I get something like this. And if I want to have any sort of screening effect whatsoever, this term shouldn't dominate. So this term here should be at least of order the Gravitino mass. If I then just turn the crank and go through the calculations, it turns out I actually get a constraint on chi zero. And it actually says that chi zero has to be less than 10 to the minus 33.
And I've 10 to the minus 33 over 1 or squared.
Oh, sorry, you're right. That squared shouldn't be there. Yeah. So essentially it says I cannot screen any object in the universe using these supersymmetric theories. Well, sorry, every object in the universe is completely screened. I cannot get any observational effects at the background level. There is an exception to this for those of you who know about supersymmetry. This is what are called no-scale models. So they've got Kähler potentials which look like this, and it turns out this is exactly the correct Kähler potential to avoid this correction to the mass coming from the Gravitino. And this is how you can get around the theorem. The issue is I've tried very, very hard. I've spent almost a year trying to come up with a model based on no-scale potentials which do this. And generally, it's very, very difficult. And the reason is if you canonically normalize the scalar fields, you tend to get a runaway potential. So the absolute very best you're going to get is e to the minus phi plus rho e to the phi. And these are known not to screen. So I think you need some sort of multi-field model. And this is one of the things that I'm still working on if I get a bit of spare time. So for that reason, you can say, well, can I construct other chameleon models and can I get any sort of novel effects whatsoever? And the answer is you can. You can get it at the effects of linear perturbations in cosmology. So if I take a model which looks like this, again, I don't want to go into the technical details. This is just for people who are interested in supersymmetry. It turns out I can get a chameleon. And the chameleon looks like this. So the blue line is the scalar potential. The red line is the coupling. And I get a curve, an effect of potential which looks like this. Cosmologically, the field just sits at its minimum and just tracks it. This is what normal chameleons do. There are no features here. But there are features at the level of linearized perturbations for cold dark matter. So if I look at perturbations for cold dark matter on cosmological scales, I get an equation which looks like this. So it looks very much like the equation you get in general relativity, except you get this effective value of g here. And this thing is both scale dependent and time dependent. And it essentially says on very, very large scales, I get big enhancements in my effective Newton's constant. On small scales, the screening kicks in. And I can solve this. I'm not going to write down the solution because it looks absolutely horrible. You write them down in polynomials multiplied by modified Bessel functions. So rather than that, let me just show you the results. If it comes up. So what we've plotted here is the power spectrum in chameleon, in supersymmetric chameleon gravity, compared with lambda CDM, as divided by the lambda CDM power spectrum. The red line is what you get from the full modified Bessel solution. The green line is what happens if you try and make approximations and linearize, so there is a bit of a difference. And you can find some deviations. There are deviations on 10 to the minus, on large-ish scales at the level of 10 to the minus 1 or so. But this is very parameter dependent. So you can get novel features at the level of perturbations in cosmology. You cannot detect supersymmetric chameleons any other way. So that's all I wanted to tell you about supersymmetric chameleons.
Yeah. I guess I'm confused. You were saying there are all these novel theorems, but now you're talking about
particle model. So it turns out, and it's something I didn't quite expect, what's happening is most chameleons have a very small coupling to matter, so say beta of order 1, and they have a very, very small mass. In these supersymmetric chameleons, the reason this no-go theorem screens, that you have a very, very large coupling to matter. The coupling to matter is of order 10 to the 9 or so, but it screens because your mass is of order 1 eV. So it turns out at the level of linearized perturbations, the coupling to matter wins. So this 10 to the 9 coupling is just so strong that you can still get these small deviations. It took me a while to understand that. And so if you can find another region where the mass isn't so important, but the coupling is. The no-go theorem only states that there are no unscreened objects in the universe, so I cannot use astrophysical effects to understand this. It doesn't say anything about what happens on cosmological scales, because cosmology doesn't depend on chi-zero. It depends more on how the two different potentials in the metric respond to the field.
You were saying cosmologically that the tracks the minimum.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, that's true. So that actually came out after we did this work. So what Latham's talking about is the fact that if you try and evolve a chameleon, so the potential looks something like that. If you try and evolve a chameleon through the radiation era, because you get particles decoupling, you get small kicks in the trace of the energy momentum tensor, and this essentially smashes the chameleon into this wall. But the issue is the chameleon mass scale is of order, say, 10 to the 3, the Hubble scale. And of course, this thing is set by Big Bang nuclear synthesis. So this wall here is about MeV, and they find very large particle production. So it's still being debated in the field. It's not quite known whether the chameleon can roll out and assume its normal solution after this. Our model doesn't suffer from these problems as much. only because we only couple to dark matter, we don't couple to the observable sector, and so for that reason these kicks don't affect the trace, don't affect the chameleon. But yeah, it's still with the dark matter, the dark matter particles decouple, you'll still get a kick. Yeah. This generally constrains the value of beta at the time of Big Bang nucleus synthesis. So what you could do is you could go back and then say, well, is there a range of beta or a range of parameters which is ruled out to avoid this? And yeah, the answer is probably yes. It's something I haven't looked at yet.
Yeah, I think her statement was that she more or less thought she had ruled out.
It rules out a lot of models. The only ones it doesn't rule out, it doesn't rule out symmetrons, because symmetrons, these kicks don't matter because you're already sitting in the minimum of the effect potential. The other one it doesn't rule out is phi to the fourth theory, because phi to the fourth theory doesn't have a mass scale associated with it, so you don't have this mismatch in the scales which causes this kicking problem. Yep.
With the P of K shifts.
Yep.
How big are those shifts compared to like SDSS error bars over that scale of K?
I
plotted some like relative.
I don't know off the top of my head. I could probably look it up. Okay, so let me leave supersymmetry behind and talk about some of the work I've done on astrophysical tests of modified gravity. So the way I do this is I embed modified theories of gravity into stellar structure. So before you go into all the details, you can actually get some real nice physical intuition for this. So you can say, well, what are stars? They're big balls of hydrogen gas. They support themselves from gravitational collapse by burning fuel at their center, and this produces an outward pressure gradient. So what happens if I take a star in general relativity, put it into a dwarf galaxy, and let it become unscreened? Well, this means that I'm going to get stronger gravitational forces in the outer layers. This means that if I want to support myself against this increased force, I need to burn more fuel per unit time, and it means that I release more energy per unit time, my star's going to be brighter, hotter, more compact, and the internal structure is going to change. So the way this works is using the stellar structure equations. So there are four equations of stellar structure for non-relativistic stars. This is the only important one for gravitational physics. So this says that if I want to support a static object against gravitational collapse using some pressure gradient, I better satisfy this equation, otherwise I'm going to either expand or I'm going to either contract. So what happens when I change my theory of gravity? Well, all that really happens is this value of g changes here. So the way we generally do this is we derive the new equations of stellar structure in modified gravity. It looks like some shift in g or some radial dependent shift in g. And then you can use this to calculate the new structure. And because I talked about some of this in May, I'm not going to talk about how you do this analytically for very simple stars. I'm going to talk about more how you do observational tests and compare this with data. Yeah.
Sorry, when you do this in GR, don't you get like
for relativistic stars, yes. We're interested in non-relativistic stars because we want situations where you're very, very underdense. So if we want to test Newtonian potentials of say 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 8, GR corrections are going to be of this order, are going to come in at this order, so they're not important for tests of modified gravity.
But then why would you want little stars
when you
have all sorts of
regions over them? So people have done this, and they're actually the weakest constraints in the literature. And the reason is, neutron stars, I think it's 5/18 for the standard Tolman Oppenheimer Volkoff star that gives you for the Newtonian potential. But we've already said that current constraints place chi zero less than 10 to the minus 5, so the mismatch is order of 10 to the 5, and this means you're going to be screened very, very heavily in these neutron stars, so you get a very, very tiny effect. I'm going to talk later on about neutron stars because there are other theories of modified gravity which I think can be probed very well using neutron stars. So, did you have a question? No. Okay, so remember RS is the screening radius. If I include chameleon theories of modified gravity, I can replace G by a radial dependent value of G, which looks like this. So I've done some analytic work on this as well, which I spoke about in May. Here I'm just going to talk to you about how we compare with data. So what I've done is I've taken a stellar structure code MESA, which can produce some great consistent stars. It's good enough to be able to compare with data. And I've implemented chameleon gravity into MESA, and it solves the field equations, computes the value of G, it finds the screening radius, and it can predict the new properties of non-relativistic stars in these theories. So let's...
So that's an approximation for the equation, for the solution, or...
The approximation is that there's no force in the interior, in the interior to the screening radius. Whereas this is not quite true. Philip Chang has done this using the full nonlinear Gauss-Seidel solver, and he gets the exact same results, and we've compared everything, and they agree perfectly. And it just helps with the convergence time, especially if you need to run lots of simulations. So I'm not going to go into the technical details and what's interesting, the results. So what I've plotted here are tracks in the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, or color magnitude diagram, for solar mass stars in F of R gravity, which have alpha equals a third. So the black track here, temperature increases this way, luminosity increases this way, is a star in general relativity. Starts off here on the zero-age main sequence, evolves up here, and then it becomes a red giant in this region here. So at 10 to the minus 6, you get this red track here. It's a small shift compared with general relativity. Bear in mind this is a logarithmic scale. And the reason for this is exactly what I told you at the start. These stars have Newtonian potentials of order 10 to the minus 6. I've put in a parameter of order 10 to the minus 6, and so my star is only marginally unscreened in this region. In this region here, my star's a red giant, its radius has increased to 10 times that as it was over here. The Newtonian potential has dropped by a factor of 10, and this is why you get a much larger difference here. So red giant stars, post-main sequence stars, are great probes of modified gravity. Right. Okay, and let me tell you how we actually probe this, because of course this thing's not a physical, this is not a physical observable. You cannot go out and measure this track. You need some way of comparing with data. So the way we do that is distance indicators. Yeah.
So for a given luminosity, you're shifted down in temperature by a
order. You're actually shifted up. So the way you should compare these two is by taking a point here and shifting it diagonally upwards. The other thing that I haven't shown is the shift in the age. So for example, if I take this point here and it's at some age, call it T1, this will not be at the same age. This, the equivalent point in modified gravity will actually be at a slightly younger age because these stars, they burn fuel faster, so they evolve faster.
The equivalent point, you mean same mass, same age, and it's like the same age?
If you want the same age, so for example, a star at this age here will correspond to something up here, or it'll be shifted along the relative curve. And in fact, if you go to slightly smaller parameters, if you go to 10 to the minus 5, it looks completely different. You can't even compare the two curves because it takes a one solar mass star and makes it look like a two solar mass star. Going to go.
Is there an easy way to say why the effect? What is the difference between the effect?
So what's happening is I'm burning fuel in my center at a faster rate. So I'm going to evolve a lot faster. But because I'm burning at a faster rate, I'm releasing more energy per unit time. So this is why the luminosity is increasing. It turns out it's not always the case, but for main sequence stars, the equilibrium configuration prefers a smaller radius. And if you prefer a smaller radius, your temperature profile doesn't decrease as quickly, so you get a hotter star as well. But that's not necessarily the case. So for post-main sequence stars, quite often the radius is insensitive to modified gravity, and it's all in the luminosity. It really depends on the physics, and that's because the physics driving post-main sequence stars are convection in the envelope. Right, so the way we actually probe this observation is using distance indicators. So the idea is as following. How do I measure the distance to a distant galaxy? Well, I've got some set of variables x which I measure on a telescope or on a computer screen, and I use some formula to convert these measurements into a distance to my galaxy. So what happens if, how do I get this formula? Well, there are two ways. I can either empirically calibrate it on stars in the nearby universe, so I calibrate on screen galaxies, or I can derive it from my theory of gravity. If I derive it from my theory of gravity, it applies only in general relativity. So then what happens if I've got, say, modified gravity and my formula's different? Well, this means I'm going to get the wrong distance. So let me give you an example of how this works. Just take something very, very simple, luminosity distance. The flux is the luminosity divided by the distance squared. I can measure the flux. This is my variable x on my computer screen. But I somehow need some sort of standard candle with some luminosity L. And this is something which I put in from my theory. I say my theory predicts this, and I'm going to assume my theory is correct. But what if my theory is not correct? Suppose that in a modified theory of gravity, the luminosity is brighter. So if the luminosity is greater, this thing's just a number which I've measured on a computer screen. If I put in the general relativity value, I'm going to put in a luminosity which is too small. So to compensate, I'm going to have to infer a distance which is too small. I'm going to underestimate the distance to this galaxy. So how can I use this to probe modified gravity? Well, I need to take two different distance measurements. I need to take one distance measurement, which depends strongly on gravity, which is I'm going to call an unscreen distance measurement. I'm doing on time. I can take another distance measurement, which is not very dependent on gravity. You can go. Sorry, I'm just waiting for this thing to go forwards. Okay, right. So I take two distance measurements. One of them depends strongly on gravity. One of them doesn't. For this reason, if I compare the two, they should not agree. And this is the idea behind using distance indicators to probe modified gravity. So let me introduce you to two of the distance indicators which we've used. First of all, we have tip of the red giant branch stars. These are post-main sequence stars which have evolved up the red giant branch. Their temperature is very, very high. As they climb up, the temperature in the core increases. At 10 to the 8 Kelvin, they suddenly have a helium flash, so they suddenly move in the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, and they leave a visible discontinuity. And this is set by nuclear physics because it depends on the helium cross-section, not on gravitational physics. So this is insensitive to my theory of gravity. And for this reason, it's actually, if you measure in the I band, it's a very, very sharp cutoff. So if you see here, it's only plus or minus 0.1 on this line here. So it's a very good distance indicator. You know very much what this luminosity is. You can use it as a standard candle. So this thing doesn't care about modified gravity. The other distance indicator we use are Cepheid distances. And Cepheid distances care a lot about modified gravity. So what are Cepheid distances? Well, they're stars which have gone off the main sequence of 5 to 10 solar masses. They exhibit these loops in the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. And when they cross this strip here, the instability strip, they pulsate. And they pulsate with a very well-known, very well-measured period luminosity relation. This is the period luminosity relation, and it basically says if I know the period of my star, I can calculate its luminosity. I can use this thing as a standard. I can use this to calculate the luminosity distance. And it turns out the period of oscillation actually depends on g, scales like 1 over the square root of g. So this thing is sensitive to gravity. It looks like this. For those of you like me who aren't really astronomers, you're more theorists, this might look a bit scary, but actually, this thing here, the magnitude, scales like the log of the luminosity. The periods looks like the log of the density, so it scales like the log of the radius. And this thing here, B minus V, scales like the log of the temperature. So this is actually just the Stefan-Boltzmann law in disguise. So what happens in modified gravity? Well, in modified gravity, where are we? I change G. If I change G, I change the period of pulsations. I change the inferred distance calculated using the general relativity calibrated formula. So what I can do is I can go back. I can perturb this by perturbing G. Okay. And what I find is that the change in my distance compared with general relativity is given by minus 0.3 delta g over g. Delta g over g we calculate using Mieser profiles at the blue edge of the instability strip. And delta d can be calculated because I've got the Cepheid distance, which is the new modified distance. I've got the tip of the red giant branch distance, which doesn't care about gravity, it only cares about general relativity. So by comparing delta d over d in screened and unscreened galaxies, we can probe chi0. And so let me just show you the results. I'm not going to go into all the details. The results look like this. So these are the new constraints we get. The old constraint coming from cosmology is this black dot up here. Chi e's on the left, alpha's on the right, so we can compare how unscreened something is as a function of how large the fifth force is. And we've been able to place incredibly strong new constraints on these parameters. So we've got the 1 and 2 sigma confidence levels. So for f of r gravity, which is alpha as a third, which is around here, the number we're reporting is something like 4 times 10 to the minus 7. So this is a couple of orders of magnitude better than the previous constraints.
Where do you get your... What objects are you using?
We're using unscreened dwarf galaxies from that screening map, which I told you about at the start. So this is where we were in May, and this was the final plot which I showed when I spoke here in May. But in the meantime, I've been doing a bit more work on this. And it turns out we can actually do a lot better than this. There are some new interesting effects. So when we calculated delta g over g, we had to use a general relativity approximation. We perturbed the period luminosity relation, and we calculated delta g over g using Mieser. But of course, this isn't really what you should do. What you should do is a full hydrodynamic analysis. You should derive the modified period luminosity relation, and you should find this by solving for the modified eigenfrequencies of pulsation. So this is exactly what I've done. And it turns out there are two new effects, one of which I wasn't expecting. The periods are even smaller than we expected, so we can place new, even stronger constraints. And it turns out stars are actually more stable in modified gravity. So how do I do this? You take the equation of motion for fluid elements in modified gravity hydrodynamics. So the acceleration for some fluid element is given by the pressure gradient and the force per unit mass. And you include the gravitational force and the modified force coming from chameleon gravity. And you look at radial perturbations. So by radial perturbations, what do I mean? You've got some fluid element at some radius r, and you perturb it by a little bit, and you say, how does this fluid element respond to perturbations in modified gravity? The derivation is horrible. It took me 2 months and another month to check it, so I'm not going to show you that. I'm going to show you the results. Before I show you the results, let me just show you what happens in general relativity. So in general relativity, you parameterize your perturbations by this decomposition here. And what you're really interested in is this thing omega, the frequency of pulsations. This thing gamma is called the adiabatic index. It just tells you how the pressure responds to changes in the density. So what you get in general relativity is what's known as the linear adiabatic wave equation, which is this thing here. It's got some sort of driving, some sort of acceleration term. It's got a mass term. And this thing here is an unknown eigenfrequency. And this is a Sturm-Liouville problem. It's just like quantum mechanics. I've got some boundary condition at the center of the star. I've got some boundary condition at the radius of the star. If I can find a solution which satisfies the boundary conditions for some value of omega, omega is an eigenvalue of my system, and this is a period of oscillation. So let me tell you what happens in modified gravity. Well, in general, I've got the expression for any theory of scalar tensor modified gravity, but here I'm specifying to chameleon theories. So in chameleon theories, you get an extra term here, which looks like this, and it's negative compared to this mass term here. So you correct the mass, the effective mass of your perturbation, zeta. So this is what I'm calling the modified linear adiabatic wave equation. If you can solve this using some sort of pulsational calculator, you can find the new eigenfrequencies, and you can find the new pulsational properties of your star in modified gravity. So this is exactly what I've done. And again, I'm not going to go into the technical details because pulsation calculators are horrible. Let me give you two examples. The first one is an analytic model, which I previously looked at but haven't told you about today, called a Lane-Enders model. It's a star with no physics. It's got a ball of gas, and it collapses under its own gravity and then produces some pressure profile, which supports itself. It's got this equation of states. And I've taken a star with Newtonian potential of order 10 to the minus 7. So what I'm showing here is the period of pulsation in modified gravity compared with general relativity as a function of how unscreened I am. So I'm more unscreened on the right because chi0 is larger. The blue curve shows what happens if you don't include modified gravity perturbations. So this is sort of like our approximation of Tsefiid's. The red curve is the full modified gravity problem. And you can see the shift is actually quite large. You get order 10 to the minus 1, so change in the period. This is just a nice little toy model. What you really want to know is, can I actually use this compared to data? Can I get better approximations? And the answer is yes. So what I've done here is use my pulsation calculator on Cepheid meso models with my new equations coming from hydrodynamics. So I've taken three values here. These are the values which we reported in our previous paper for chi0 and alpha. This is what our approximation gave. And this is what I get if I don't include the effects of modified gravity hydrodynamics, if I just take modified gravity stars and put them into the general relativity equation. So you can see that our approximation agrees very well with the full problem if you don't include modified hydrodynamics. If you include modified hydrodynamics, and I was surprised by this, the answer actually goes up by a factor of 3. The change in the distance is a lot larger. And this means we can place new constraints, and this is currently work in progress, using exactly the same data sets. I haven't got the new constraints yet because I still need to generate all the models, but what I can do is I can estimate exactly how low we can probe as a function of alpha and chi0. So what I've done here is I've just taken lots of different stars, calculated the models at the red edge, calculated the new value of delta d over d, and I've kept going down in chi0 until this computed value here agrees with this previous approximation, so the same amount of screening. This won't necessarily give you a rigorous bound because, of course, if you change chi0, your galaxy sample changes as well, and there are statistics to account for, but it's a very rough approximation. And the results are quite surprising. It looks like we can probe into the regime 10 to the minus 8. Bear in mind, below 1 times 10 to the minus 8 or a few times 10 to the minus 8, you've ruled out the theory. So we're hoping to get some very good constraints from this.
So you're looking for this systematic offset in the measure of distances.
Yeah.
So this is limited by your sample size?
It's limited. So if you look at our constraints, Sorry, this is going to take a while to go back. Let's have a look. Sorry, let me just go back to the figure quickly. It's limited essentially by our sample size, yes. The other issue is that the period luminosity relation also depends on mass. So if you want to have a very, very unscreened star, you need to look at 10 solar mass stars. So now you need to make a mass measurement. And as soon as you make a mass measurement in astrophysics, your error bars go shooting up. So this is another... I've gone too far now. So let me just get back to the plot.
Does the modifier gravity change the location of the instability
strip? I believe it does. At the moment, I can't calculate it because I'm only using an adiabatic code. But again, non-adiabatic effects and driving terms, they don't care about gravity. They only care about...
So Cepheids, I thought, were driven by ionization.
Instability,
and
yeah.
Right? And that's going to depend upon how fast it can adiabatically expand, which will care about the modified gravity and placement potentials the lowest, the most likely to be significant.
Mm. Yeah, it's something we're starting to think about. I think I know how to do it, how to find the location of the instability strip. You need to go to non-adiabatic pulsation codes. The paper for this only came out a couple of weeks ago, so I haven't gotten around to it. Can you see that the edges are very jagged? This is because as soon as you change chi-0, some of your galaxies go from being screened to unscreened, and so your sample size flips very suddenly. LSST will probe variable stars in lots of different galaxies, so we're hoping that data from there will be able to help us smooth these contours out a bit and maybe get the constraints down even further.
Is there any astrophysical systematic that would lead to a difference between red giant brands and Cepheid?
There are, and I'll show you it. It's at the very, very end of my talk, so if you don't mind, just to save time on flicking through, I'll show you at the very end. Right, so I started at 11:07 and it's now 12. Do people, I can either stop here or I can go on for 5 minutes or so. What do people want? Okay, sure. Right, so let me tell you about stellar stability. Just like in quantum mechanics, I've got a Stern-Liouville eigenvalue problem. I can use variational methods to find an upper bound on the ground state energy. I can do exactly the same thing with this Stern-Liouville equation here. I construct some functional, and the lowest eigenfrequency must be less than this. If this thing's imaginary, because I've got an e to the I omega t here, I'm going to get growing and decaying modes. So this tells me a bit about whether my star's stable or not. In general relativity, I get a universal bound. I find that my star is stable, provided that this adiabatic index is larger than 4/3. Something I wasn't quite expecting in modified gravity, but just came out of the equations, is that actually stars are more stable in modified gravity. And the reason for this is you've got higher gravity in the outer layer. You're trying to propagate sound waves within your star, and it's harder for them to propagate in the outer layers. So the result I find is that the critical value is the general relativity value minus alpha, which is the strength of the fifth force, times some order one composition dependent factor. So I've gone ahead and I've calculated this. I've taken the same lane into model before. I've changed the value of gamma. So now I'm plotting gamma versus how unscreened I am. And so I get these two curves here. The blue curve is when I don't include the background change in my star, so I don't include the effect on the background structure. The red one is what you get once you include all modified gravity effects. So it turns out there are two competing effects here. The modified gravity perturbations try and make your star more stable. The background structure with the modified gravity perturbations turned on makes you slightly less stable, but it's still more stable than general relativity. This is a very nice effect. So far, I can't think of a use for it as an astrophysical probe because it goes in the wrong direction you're looking for. Increased stability effects rather than things like a higher supernova rate or stars which should be stable being unstable. Right, so in the last couple of minutes, let me just tell you a tiny bit about what I'm doing then. There are still more astrophysical effects that we have yet to exploit. There are still more tests of modified gravity out there. So what I'm doing now, I'm working with Kazuo Koyama at Portsmouth and Bao Zhuli at Durham. We're trying to actually calculate the spectra of galaxies, dwarf galaxies in voids, using isochrones created from MESA. And this means we need to include time-dependent effects because galactic properties depend on their cumulative effects. They accumulate different metallicities, different types of stars over time. So on the bottom here, we're plotting the scale factor. On the left-hand side, we're plotting the self-screening parameter as a function of time. For very, very heavy halos, this is always less than 10 to the minus 7. You can't probe there. But for very, very light halos, dwarf galaxies, you actually become unscreened sometime in the past. So by including time dependence in MESA, we're hoping to predict this new spectra. So what I'm showing now is general relativity in blue, modified gravity in red. The green curve, which interpolates between the two, is what happens once you include time dependence. So you start off very screened in the past. Chameleon theories are more screened in the past. As time goes on, they get less and less unscreened, and eventually they converge to the constant track. So this means that we might not be able to get as strong a constraint as we might have done using this red curve, but we're still, we've done a few preliminary tests, and we think we should still be able to get some new and interesting constraints by looking at the spectra of galaxies. So how are we going to do that? Well, we use MESA to generate isochrones. So this is now not a Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, which I've generated. This is, each one of these points is a MESA model at some fixed metallicity and some fixed time. The red points are general relativity. The blue points are modified gravity. And these are the Padova isochrones, these gray lines here. And as you can see, they agree very well for general relativity. Modified gravity, there's a slight shift. And so by feeding these things into galaxy synthesizers, we're hoping we can calculate the modified spectra. Then the next hope is you can compare the spectra of galaxies and voids, galaxies and clusters, look for these systematic offsets, and then with these quantitative predictions, hopefully get some constraints on the parameters. The other thing I'm starting to think about is actually a different theory of gravity. I'm not going to go through the details because I'm slightly over time. It's called disformal gravity. It's got a screening mechanism in very, very dense, non-relativistic environments. All field derivatives are suppressed. But the interesting thing is it differs from every other screening mechanism in that it's sourced by pressure and not density. So the way the screening mechanism works is I source field gradients both by the density and time derivatives and the pressure with scale and with spatial derivatives. In non-relativistic objects, the pressure is negligible compared to the density, so I just get this term here, and this is what gives me the screening mechanism. So far people have looked at cosmology, they've looked at shining light through wall experiments, so I've been starting to think about, can I get any astrophysical effects on this? And this comes back to what you were saying about the Tolman Oppenheimer-Volkoff equation. I believe that relativistic stars are the perfect place to test this theory because there's a source for scalar gradients, there's absolutely no screening mechanism whatsoever. And so something that I've started to do, and I've been doing it slowly because I've got a lot of other things on at the moment, is I'm starting to derive the modified Tolman Oppenheimer-Volkoff equation for neutron stars in disformal theories of gravity. So at the moment, I'm somewhere between these two. Yeah.
100% sure, but 99%. I think mathematicians studied that equation you put there, and that's a very clear example of a completely imposed problem. So Laplacian phi equals something phi dot square. I think it's guaranteed to be to blow up.
Oh, really?
Yeah, for arbitrary initial data.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I think
okay. If you give some of the reference, that'd be great. Because, currently people are, they haven't actually solved the equation. They've sort of hand-waved that you're going to get zero. So yeah, that's. I should look at that. So I'm somewhere between these two at the moment. There are some funny effects in these theories. So for example, if you take an equation of state in the Jordan frame, in the Einstein frame, it becomes field dependent. So there's a lot of very, very technical aspects to be worked out. So you have to do it very, very carefully to make sure you get the correct answer. Other things I haven't had time to tell you about, which I'm also working on, observational tests of Einstein mechanism, planetary nebula tests of chameleon-like theories, and scalar radiation in Galilean theories. So I'm out of time. I'm going to leave my summary up there. Thank you very much for your attention. Of the local Newtonian potential, yes. So they do it. They do it by calculating the mass. So they do it by calculating the mass of the nearby stars. And so their conditions are, if GM over R is less than chi zero, then you're unscreened. If your environmental value within one Compton wavelength is less than chi zero, then you're also environmentally unscreened. The first one is technically correct and there's no problem. A lot of work from n-body simulations has shown that the second one is not technically the correct parameter to use. What you need to use is this very funny parameter called d, which cares about the lensing mass as well. So what they've done is they work very, very hard to, and if you read their paper, to calibrate this against n-body codes about when they're screened and when they're not screened, and they're very, very conservative with it. I should also answer Doddy's question about the systematics. So if I just go down one. This is a plot which I didn't show because I wanted to save time. So this is delta D over D for Cepheids versus red giant branch versus D tip of the red giant branch. This red line is the best fit for modified gravity. This black line is the best fit for general relativity in our samples. And these green lines here are the modified gravity predictions. Sorry, screened and unscreened. Red is unscreened, black is screened. So for alpha as a third, f of r gravity, this thing sits down here. For dotted lines here, this is alpha equals 1. These are even more modified. There is a gravity. They lie down here. So you can see the best fit's very, very far off. Very, very far off the prediction. If I look at systematics, so things like metallicity corrections to the period luminosity relation and things like that, you can see it actually shifts the best fit line up. So it goes in the opposite direction from modified gravity. This is not something that would be true a priori, and if it wasn't true, we'd have more problems and our constraints would be weaker. But it's just the fact that it moves in the opposite direction from the modified gravity prediction, which allows us to get some great constraints and not have to worry too much about systematics.